Hello and welcome to this week's Dalek Radio. Good afternoon, welcome to Dalek Radio. Hello to everyone in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM on 103.2, and hello to people in Birmingham, Unity FM on 93.5 in the Midlands. Our guest this week is Harriet Biles. She's a Bristol student and she's here to tell us about a recent trip to the West Bank. Features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and Malcolm Grieve reads a chapter from Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. We've also got a poem read also by Malcolm Grieve. Jess Barks is away, he's on holiday, but he sent us his What's On guide. I'm John Peters Coleman, and over to our first guest now. It's my pleasure to introduce Harriet Biles. Hello.
Hi.
Hi. You've just got back last Wednesday from travelling. Where have you been?
I've been to the West Bank in Palestine.
Okay, and you were there for about 2 months travelling around that area?
Yeah.
And you went primarily with Amnesty International, I understand, is that right?
Well, I've been a volunteer for Amnesty International in Bristol, but I actually went to join up with the International Solidarity Movement.
Okay. Do you mind if I ask how old you are?
I'm 20.
That's quite a young age, a lot of listeners would probably be thinking. Had you travelled politically, so to speak, before, apart from obviously just being abroad on holiday?
No, not really, no. I've been to India before, but I'm really passionate about human rights and I've always wanted to go to Palestine.
Okay. You seem very calm and confident. You don't seem at all bothered about the fact that a lot of people obviously think I was very dangerous. Were you worried? Well, how did you feel before you came up with the idea, I'm going to travel there? How did you feel about that?
Yeah, I was really, really quite scared before going, especially about getting into the country and the kind of interrogation that you have to go through when you're going through Israel. Because if you're doing anything that's remotely pro-Palestinian, then they will possibly deport you, but interrogate you for hours. So I was really worried about that and didn't really think very much about actually getting there.
Okay.
So then I finally arrived and, nothing could really have prepared me for what I saw there.
Okay, so who did you first suggest the idea of travelling to? Who did you travel with?
Well, I went on my own. I was alone. But I've been talking about it and thinking about it for quite a long time.
Okay, presumably with sort of Amnesty International, and I understand you're also with the International Solidarity Movement as well, is that right?
Yeah, and with the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign in Bristol as well. Yeah.
And what was their reaction?
They were very encouraging. I spoke to lots of people who had been and they thought it was the most useful thing you can do to actually go there and show your solidarity, and primarily really to report back and to raise awareness at home about what's going on, because a lot of people don't really fully know.
Okay, so how did you travel there?
Aeroplane.
Where did you land?
I arrived in Ben Gurion Airport.
Okay, and what was the customs like? Assumably, you have to say where you're going. What did they say?
Yeah, it was something
I
was so worried about, and I actually just breezed through. I just wanted to make myself look like I was going on a holiday to Tel Aviv, so I bought myself a copy of Heat magazine, which I clutched to me going through immigration. And it seemed to work, actually, and they didn't ask me any questions at all. But I do know there are lots of other volunteers who were there who were interrogated for kind of hours on end about what they were going to be doing.
It could have been interesting, but you got through. So how did you then go about getting into the West?
That's actually quite easy. A lot of people ask me the question, but you just go to Jerusalem and then you cross over the apartheid wall. And there's no kind of checkpoints going in, but it's coming out of the West Bank that they have this big system of checkpoints where Palestinians are made to get off of the bus and they have to go through basically these kind of cages, and it can take hours for them to pass, and they go through individually and they'll be kind of interrogated, ask questions, their bags searched, that kind of thing. And so that's the kind of thing I have to go through every time you're leaving the West Bank, and often within the West Bank as well, moving from place to place. It's one of the biggest points about this kind of system of apartheid, is that there's no freedom of movement.
Okay, so to the uninitiated, what does it actually look like when you arrive in the West Bank? What is there?
Well, yeah, it's a very, very strange place. On all the hilltops, you see these settlements, these red-roofed houses where they've just been kind of growing and growing. These are kind of Israeli settlers who have moved in and gradually kind of consuming the hilltops and circling the villages. The settlements often consume the land, burn down olive trees, things like that. So that kind of strikes you straight away, this very strange, like two cultures living side by side.
So what do the Palestinian dwellings look like as opposed to the...
Yeah, it's completely different. I mean, there's a lot of refugee camps, there's a lot of poverty. But people live very simply. They have their farms, they have their small houses. And
did you meet and chat to Israeli people, presumably while you were there as well as Palestinians?
Yeah.
What did they seem like? Did they seem... I don't know. I mean, it sounds like there's this element of inhumanity to their cruel-sounding treatment of the Palestinians, but what did they seem like when you spoke to them?
Well, I don't think you can really generalise, like, all Israelis are like this or all Palestinians are like that. Yeah. I spent a lot of my time in Jerusalem, and unfortunately, like, the society there is very, very divided. It's either kind of soldiers or Orthodox Jews or kind of settlers or religious Jews walking around, or like Americans who have moved to Israel because they think it's their birthright. So yeah, I had a lot of strange conversations with very radical people in Jerusalem who claim that God has given them this land and this is why they're entitled to kind of steal people's houses and do the terrible things they do. So that's kind of worrying. But then on the other side, there's a lot of Israeli activists who really hate what they see, and they've been brought up in this world where they're in an occupying country. And that, I think, must be one of the most difficult things in the world. And so they do a lot of good things. Then there's probably a lot of apathetic people as well who just don't really think about it. You know, in Tel Aviv, it's just any other city. And they're kind of maybe oblivious about the things that are going on so near in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Okay. So how much of this sort of clashed with what you'd expect to find, or perhaps what you hadn't thought about in you know, in preparation for the trip? And what does it? Did you wake up in the morning sort of feeling nervous, scared, hopeful? You know, what were you...
Yeah, I think there was no way I really could have fully prepared to see this system of ethnic cleansing and to see the way that people live and the way their lives are made so difficult. Yeah, I didn't really imagine it would look like it did. I knew all the facts about what was going on in the West Bank, but...
So what did you actually do when you were there? Did you engage in resistance to the Israelis or anything like that? Or?
Yeah, there are demonstrations every week in most of the villages against things like the wall, which wiggles all around the green line. I don't know if you've ever seen a map, but it's quite horrifying how this wall basically steals people's land or cuts off villages from their land or even cuts villages in half. So there's a lot of demonstrations about things like that, security fences, which, again, confiscate people's olive trees and things like that.
Is the International Solidarity Movement helping to organise a lot of these? Or
they don't organise it because it's primarily always Palestinian-led, so we just support whatever the Palestinians are doing in their villages to resist the occupation.
Okay. And you travelled around various places, sort of Hebron, Nablus, Jordan Valley, these sort of areas. I mean, what were the difference between the areas like, especially for the quality of life of Palestinians? And...
Yeah, there's a huge difference between every village you go to. They've all got their stories and their terrible things that have happened, and they've got their own way of resisting as well, which is amazing. But the other thing is that because of the difficulty of moving around and of communication between these places, the resistance movements aren't fully coordinated. And it's something they're really working on, is becoming united. But each village is fighting its own battle, really, against the military, which are surrounding them, and the settlers. So, yeah, that's something they're having meetings about. They're trying to unite and come together.
OK, so how do the Israeli military and police react to having Palestinians around? Do they just sort of oversee things, or are they quite proactively anti-Palestinian in the way that they operate?
It's a pretty disproportionate response, really, from the military. That was one thing, again, which really shocked me so much. Yeah, I mean, in every demonstration, they respond by firing tear gas and sound bombs at non-violent, peaceful demonstrators. And I think we'll all agree that we have the right to peacefully demonstrate. But without exception, every time the military would either shoot tear gas from a gun, like a bullet, at people, which has caused a lot of injuries and deaths in the past, or they'll throw it at you or shoot sound bombs, which don't really do any damage other than being very hot and very scary. But they're all there to diffuse the protest.
I mean, when you chat to Israelis and Palestinians verbally, do they come across as up for a fight, or do they talk about the peace process? You know, anything like the two-state solution or anything like that?
Yeah, they're some of the most political people you'll ever meet. Even the very young Palestinian kids have got a really good idea about politics, and non-violent resistance is really, really key in all of these villages because they've had such a violent history, and so they really are reaching for how can we do this in a non-violent way, because they realise how powerful that is when they look at other examples around the world as well.
And what about on the Israeli side? Do you, especially in the areas where they are, where they have the settlements?
Well, from what I can see, although it's very difficult to get to talk to settlers because they're these kind of people living on hilltops and there's so much security. And
so you're not actually allowed really to go.
You're not allowed to go into the settlement. So I only saw them from the Palestinian side. A lot of them, well, most of them are armed with M16s, and I've seen them walking around the hills with these guns threatening Palestinians. A lot of them are very, very militant. Some of them are living in settlements purely for economic reasons because they get large subsidies and support from the government. But some of them live in very small settlements in very contentious areas, and they just want to getting right. the land for themselves yeah. in very violent and scary okay. ways.
Well, how can people, if people are inspired by this, lastly, I mean, what would you persuade people to do and where to go? You know, who could they get in touch with?
If people feel that they want to go to Palestine to support the people there, then that's a really valuable thing to do, especially during the months of end of September or October, because that's when the olive harvest is.
Who can they get in touch with?
They can get in touch with the Palestinian Solidarity Campaign in Bristol, with okay. International Solidarity Movement, ISM. They have a website. And yeah, that's definitely the best way to do it, because Palestinians need people to accompany them while they harvest their olives, because that's when settlers will attack them quite a lot.
Okay, well, Harriet Bowles, thank you very much for sharing some of that with us. Thank you. Well, some music now from the album Roxy Music. There's an interview later on with Graham Simpson. This man founded Roxy Music and played bass guitar with them in 1971 to 1972. After the first year, he was eventually fired by Brian Ferry and he went off to India. That was Roxy Music. More from Graham Simpson later on. With history in mind, let's go over to our first feature by Tony Gosling. It's an interview with local historian Julian Lee Jones.
We wondered why Water Lane was called Water Lane, and we were told that it was named after a Mr. Waters or something like that. But we started looking into the story a bit more, and we happened to be interviewing somebody who... Mr. Floyd. There used to be a firm on Waters Lane called Farvises who made sheet metal work and made funnels for small ships. In fact, because of the hauling way where they used to come out from their works, he was explaining to us that they had to actually make the funnels in the yard, and then they used to have to take them out into the street through the hauling way, and then they could only assemble them out in the roadway at night when everybody else, all the other factories around about, had closed down. And he then went on to say how that when they pulled their premises down in the 1960 for that ghastly place called Norfolk House, apologies to the IR, that they found the place was made of ship's masts, that all the beams were ship's masts. And so we started looking into this, and we started amassing evidence. Then we found in Evans' history, 1824 history of Bristol, he makes mention there that when they were digging the ground for putting a pump in the yard of the pottery, rings, and 45 foot down they found pieces of hewn timber. We only spoke to somebody in who was her parents, grandparents ran the Shakespeare, and she remembers a flagstone in the cellar, which used to flood quite often, and there was a stream running underneath it. So we wondered at this stage whether there was actually a stream, and Waters Lane was. The next thing we discovered was that if you go along and look from the riverside, you can find there's an arched opening where water is trickling out, groundwater, what have you. And if you look on Millard's 1673 map of Bristol, you'll see that it shows an inlet there with a couple of ships in it, or a ship in it. We then spoke to somebody in the museum about this, and they, at that time, poo-pooed it and said, oh no, it was just fanciful, conjectural. We then carried on doing some more research, and lo and behold, Joseph Bryant of the famous Bristol rope-making firm came to see us, because on the Millard's 1672 map, it shows along the front of Temple Back a rope house, which is a long, low shed where they sort of spun the rope out. And it was his great-great-grandfather was rope maker to a Lady Mary Green, if I remember rightly. And anyway, in amongst his family deeds, he came across this letter. It was just one of those serendipity moments that Mr. Wilding had been paid in 1740s to build a new roping house and arch over the dock at the east end of Water Lane. So we're getting there, we're getting there. And then another one of our friends and members, Michael Bagent, who has written hosts of books on the Templars, he was doing some research on the Templars in La Rochelle, which was the main Templar port. And in the port rolls there, he found the two ships registered at the Templar ships registered at Bristol. So then when we went back and presented this, and everybody said, oh yes, well, of course, we realised it was a dock all the time. And it quite often works out like that. But basically, the Templars needed a dock because they would have been shipping, moving the wools from, because they were licensed to export wool, and they would have been taking wool from the Cotswolds, from Temple Gyting and the farms around there, down through Bristol. So we now have a dock, we have the Waters Lane, we have the stream. The water is still running out there today, albeit just a little bit of groundwater now. So that became our next major discovery.
Is Bristol quite a good city to be in? Do you think there's still a lot of uncovered treasures out there?
All the time, all the time. I mean, with the Temple History Group now, most of our stuff and research is collaborative between the members and put on our website, the History For You website. But there's a Templar sort of password protected page for the members hidden away under there. But no, I'm writing for a number of community magazines, and every month I manage to write two or three articles of something new. And to give you an example, Diane, my wife, who's also been involved in this for, well, as long as I have, I was writing an article about the maternity, what people still refer to as the maternity hospital, the big red brick building at the top of Redland Hill. And I was writing for the Redland magazine before it was the maternity hospital. It's now a firm of consultant engineers in there, and before that it was a nurse's home, before that it was a maternity hospital. It was the Queen Victoria Convalescent Hospital, but going back before that, it was a school called Wainfleet, a prep school, a very, very large prep school. Now, we were writing up this, and I got permission from the current owners to actually go in and take some photographs of the building, and we noticed, and this has never been reported anywhere before, and this is a good example of the sort of things that you can still find out today. Around the top of that red brick building, about 30 foot up, are terracotta plaques, about 2 foot square, of coats of arms. They're coats of arms of public schools: Harrow, Eton, Rugby, Sherborne. And why do you think these? And Diane spotted these. Well, I spotted them and we photographed, and when I looked at the photograph of the when I blew it up and looked at it on the screen and realised there were these plaques. And then Diane did the research and found out which schools they belong to. So why have you got a coat of arms for Eton or Harrow or Rugby on a building in the middle of Bristol? And there's one plaque that we still haven't actually found out who it represents or what establishment it represents. And what it was, the headmaster, it was two reasons for doing it. One, it was as a puff for the pupils' parents to show sort of the aspirational, and it looked really good to have all of these coats of arms. And presumably it was also aspirational from the point of view of the pupils. But you won't find that written anywhere, apart from when we did the research. So there is hosts of things. I would, maybe it's called the low history. It's not the great fantastic, but it's always these little things that put the flesh on the bones of the city, I think.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much to Julian Lee Jones and to Tony for that feature. Time to follow that with another feature by Tony Gosling now. It's about the railways, and it's a recording made by Dr. Beeching.
But I think people forget how much freight went by rail in the 1960s. I mean, my father had a nursery in Bath then, and I remember going with him down to the goods yard in Midland Road to put trees and shrubs onto the rails, and off they would go. And Beeching analysed that and found that it was totally not cost effective. And so he stopped it almost overnight and said, well, the way forward is bulk transport like coal to power stations, petroleum, etc., produce that would make up a whole train and go from A to B. I think that would have happened anyway, simply because the road hauliers could always undercut the railways. I think, you know, it would have, might have taken 10 years, but I think that would have happened simply because the railways and the way they operated could not have competed with the road haulage industry. I mean, I think the problem the railways have, it's like thinking that they have their own road and, you know, all the motorists, they share a road, motorways, etc. Railways are a specialist sort of road, but only the railways use them. So they had all, and they still do, have all the overheads of maintaining and keeping those specialist roads, which they call railways, under repair, and that's very expensive.
What about for people who are enthusiastic about railways nowadays? Are we pretty well served in the West Country for these preserved steam lines?
Yes, I think it's interesting that, you know, I was at Minehead yesterday on the West Somerset Railway, and we were talking about it there. And, of course, Minehead was closed by the Beeching Plan in, I think, 1971. But had it stayed open, there would have been just a single unit or a couple of coaches running up and down all day, as there is to Severn Beach, for instance. While, because it was closed and it was run by enthusiasts, you still got a 1960s branch line there. So I can stand at Blue Anchor Station and see in the distance a wisp of steam, and in comes a little tank engine in carriages, just as I did in 1963. So as far as the conserving the atmosphere of the old railways, they're very good, but they're not a commercial proposition. The railways couldn't run like that today.
You're looking at the second edition of this, which is going to be covering the Bristol and Bath area, being published probably in a year or so. You have a message for our listeners about photos to do with the railways, don't you?
Yes, I mean, there are a lot of photos published, many of them get published more than once. I'm rather looking for some new photographs to illustrate the lines that will be covered in Volume 2. They will include lines like the lines to Portishead, to Clevedon, to Severn Beach, Fish Ponds, Avonmouth, the Somerset and Dorset, or trains at any of the stations like St Anne's Park that were closed, or Yate, which closed and then opened again in the Beeching report. So if anyone has got nice collections of photographs, if they'd like to and sent them in, then the best will be used in the book.
And what about your publisher?
It's a firm really that concentrates on books of this sort. It's called the Nostalgia Collection from Silver Link Book. They're based up in the Midlands, which is not far from where I live now. They've done a big series called the Past and Present series, which shows what almost every station in the whole of Britain now they've covered, what it looked like when it was open and what it looks like now. And some of them are bypasses, some of them are housing estates, some of them still have a railway but without the signal boxes and signals. So they've pretty well covered the country with those. So this is a sort of new approach, looking at it from the Beeching angle. And each line in the that was closed gets a piece in the book. It gets a description, it gets a timetable, it gets some photographs, and it gets a little map. And it so people can look and say, well, in 1963, I could have, there were 10 trains a day, which I could have used from my local station into Bristol or whatever.
Do you think that we really wouldn't have preserved steam heritage railways in Britain now if it hadn't been for good old Dr. Beeching?
Well, from that point of view, yes. I think perhaps he's over vilified. Everyone likes a hate figure, and there are all sorts of conspiracy theories about what was going on. But and certainly there are room because of Mr. Marple's involvement with the road construction industry, that there's fertile ground there. But I think whatever government and whatever people were involved, something similar would have happened within a few years. But I think the criticism of Beeching, it was done in too cool and calculated a way. It was done too quickly. And some of the evidence, some of the statistics they used was a bit suspect. And I think, as I mentioned before, there was a public inquiry for each line. And to start with, the protesters came up with some quite, one or two lines, quite strong cases why the financial situation was different from portrayed in Beeching. And so the government didn't like that, so they actually changed what the inquiries could look at, so they could only look at hardship. So you had to prove you had hardship. They weren't allowed to put forward proposals saying that, in fact, there was a greater income or for making economies in that particular line. So it wasn't a level playing field.
Now, if you were Dr. Beeching and you could save one of the lines back in the 1960s around the Bristol and Bath area, which one would you have saved?
that's a very difficult one. Obviously, a lot of people like the idea of saving the Somerset and Dorset, but that's it was a very difficult line to work. It was through an area with a very low population. It left Bath, it went to Radstock, Chilcompton, Evercreech, Wincanton, which was about the first biggest town sort of further south. Then it went down through Shillingston and little places like that until it finally got to Poole. So it was a pretty low, densely populated area, and it was a very expensive line to work. So I find that justification in the long term difficult. So really, I don't know. I mean, I think One line, for instance, which is a little further away from here, but it will be covered by the next book, is the line through Devizes, which is quite a large town. It wasn't just a branch line, it was a secondary route to London, and it had quite a lot of commuter trains until the early 60s, actually went from Westbury to London through Devizes. And I think, some of the larger country towns like that lost their railways, I think that had more been done to encourage custom, and obviously today with more people commuting long distances, that would have been a case for saving.
Our intrepid reporter, Atsia Page, has been out on the festival trail again, from Edinburgh down to the Portobello Film Festival launch. The actual festival starts at the beginning of September, but first let's hear the theme tune from the film Cinema Paradiso, which, like the pop-up theatre under the Westway Westbourne Grove, has that great outdoor feel to it.
Jonathan Barnett, and I'm the director of the Portobello Film Festival.
And how long have you been doing that?
15 years.
Well, it's very successful, isn't it?
Yeah, it is successful because there's a lot of people out there making films now, and they have been for 15 years, but they haven't got anywhere to show them, so we're showing all the films that don't get shown on the telly or on cable.
Do you think there could be a slot on television for these films that people make and there's nowhere to show them?
Yeah, I think it'd be brilliant. An hour a week, you know, even an hour every night. There's millions of films being made and they haven't got to show them. And a lot of them, as hopefully people will see during the festival, are actually better than the stuff that you do see on the telly.
And it keeps people creative.
Exactly. I mean, it's actually easy now to make films with digital technology. So really, the only parameters are your own imagination.
So tell us more about the festival. How long does it take to organise?
Yeah, it takes about 6 months to organise it. Most of the organising is to do with programming the films, because we try and show every film that's submitted, 700 films, and then getting a few more little glamorous events on top to put a bit of shine on it. And also we have to raise the money for it every year, which is obviously getting more and more difficult all the time.
You don't get any grants?
Yeah, we do get some grants, but I can see the grants drying up.
So how many people roughly visit the festival?
It's about 15,000 a year.
That's brilliant.
But it's on for 3 weeks. There's usually at least 2 screens on every night. There's lots of films, so and I think people want to see, you know, what's kind of happening on the front line of film.
Hello, I'm with the press officer for the Portobello Film Festival. What's your name?
Ken MacDonald.
Can you tell us about the cinema? Because it's under the motorway, isn't it?
The pop-up cinema, yeah. This is our main venue. Cannes has its Palais de Cinema. We've got our pop-up cinema under the Westway, which is very obviously Portobello Road style. And this is a cinema that's been going through the summer. During the Portobello Festival, starting September 2nd, we're going to have it for the whole 3 weeks of the festival, and we'll be showing stuff here every day. So we've got a fantastic programme. We've also got 3 other venues that we're showing films at this year. We've also got a special feature this year called The Artist's Eye, which involves us inviting artists to introduce their favourite film. Then we obviously screen the film. We've got people like Blek Lerat, of whom Banksy said, "Everything I do, I discover that Lerat did it 20 years before me." He's going to do an original piece of artwork, and he's going to introduce performance.
What about Banksy himself?
Well, Banksy, you never know where he is, do you? I couldn't rule out an appearance by Banksy.
Hello.
Hello.
What's your name?
My name is David Barker.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm a filmmaker, and I also lecture in film at Kensington and Chelsea College, which is not far from where the Portobello Film Festival is taking place. I lecture in film, video, post-production, special effects, and many, many other things, including graphic design. I have recently been to India, where I shot quite a lot of film as a kind of recce for my documentary film, which concerns the Bhopal tragedy, which took place in 1984, wherein 25,000 people died. And the American organization, the company Union Carbide and Dow Chemicals, have taken no responsibility for it. And so I feel that it's useful for me to make a documentary to bring their plight to a wider public, particularly aiming at young people, because I've discovered, you mention Bhopal to people over 50 and they're kind of aware of it. You mention it to anybody under 30, they have no idea whatsoever, despite the fact that it's a bigger tragedy than 9/11 or many, many other things. It's the fact that these are poor Indian people who seem to register for very little in the wider scope of things.
Do you have a film in the festival?
Yes. I've got the trailer for the film, which is called Under Darkened Skies.
And what's it about?
The trailer is about the tragedy itself, which took place on December the 3rd, 1984. The film is also much more optimistic because they have got a very, very sound self-help group of many, many hundreds of people in Bhopal, where they've built a clinic and help for the victims, because there are children, many, many children still being born with terrible birth defects because the chemicals that went into the groundwater haven't been cleaned up.
Do you have a website?
My website is redletter.eu.
My name's Saul.
Can you tell us what you're doing here tonight?
I'm in one of the films made by Miranda and Sarah.
What's the film about?
About Graham, magnificent people.
So hi, my name's Miranda Little. I'm half of Bad Little Cook, who are making a film on Graham Simpson, former member and co-founder of Roxy Music. And you just interviewed Sol, who came down to meet Graham one day, because obviously he's a bassist, so we had a very interesting time, which you'll find out about if you watch the full documentary. We'll make a 6-minute film just now that we're going to show, which is a little bit more arty, a little bit more, you know. But we're going to look for funds and keep filming and make a full feature length on Graham's life. And, you know, the people that he keeps meeting now, because all these people are coming out of the woodwork that he hasn't seen for 40 years, because he's basically been off the radar for 40 years. Everyone thought he was dead, but, you know, he's just in Ladbroke Grove, really.
Graham Simpson,
And what band did you play in?
Roxy Music. Before that, I was in a blues band in Manchester for a year called Cock-a-Hoop, which was a very good little blues band. And then before that, I was working out with the university band in Newcastle upon Tyne, 1964 to 1968, and then eventually, what with one thing and another, Brian arrived one day and suggested we form a band, which we did. I was only ever on the first LP, which was simply called Roxy Music, and very interested in Eastern religion, and smoking an awful lot of hashish, and what with one thing and another, I sold everything I had and gave it to the poor and hit the road in search of the truth. And here I am back in Portobello tonight, none the wiser.
What instrument did you play?
Bass guitar, Gibson Cherry Red EVO from Nashville, Tennessee.
In touch with Brian Ferry?
No, Brian and I haven't been in touch since 1972, I don't think.
Hello, my name's Stuart Pound and I'm a video artist.
What does that mean?
It means that when I make video, it's a form of art.
And who do you make it for?
I make it for me, and I make it for screening in various festivals, like Portobello Film Festival, but mainly I show the work abroad. And in fact, I'm going abroad in about a couple of weeks' time to Split in Croatia, which has an experimental film festival. I used to be a filmmaker years and years ago, but then it started to get very expensive, and I now just do everything in video because it's a lot cheaper.
So what did you make years ago then?
Really long, boring films, because everyone was stoned while they watched the film, so it didn't matter if it was an hour, 2 hours long.
Any notable ones?
Notable.
That we might know?
I won a big prize in France for a film called Inventory's Codex, and it was reviewed by Margaret Duras, you know, this sort of famous French writer. Well, she was just very keen on my film, and she wrote it up in Cahiers de Cinéma. But unfortunately, I don't get anything written up in the UK. I just live in London.
Any chance coming to Bristol?
I like Bristol. Bristol's very good. They wouldn't accept me at the local university, though, 40 years ago. I was very annoyed about that. Went there to try and do physics. But Bristol's a great city.
You were talking about Margarita Duras.
I was, yes. Who was a very nice woman. About the same age as my mum. And I sort of met her a number of times. When I was at this festival in the south of France, it was a festival called the Cinéma d'Ivron, and it was sort of based in Yerres, which is near Marseille, or Toulon, in fact. And at the same festival, there was Alain Robbe-Grillet. And I was being awarded the main prize in, I think it was in 1979, so we're talking a good long time ago. And, you know, I had to keep coming up onto the stage to sort of accept various prizes. You know, there was a sort of Prix de la Critique, Prix de la blah, 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 Prix de la something like. And Robbe-Grillet was saying, stay on the stage, just stop here. But later on, or rather really before then, I actually met Robbe-Grillet, and I was sharing a taxi, and I didn't know it was Robbe-Grillet. And there was a French woman who I knew from London, and she said, oh, you do realise that guy's Robbe-Grillet. He spoke really amazingly good English. He was he wasn't sort of full of himself. He was just a really sort of regular guy, and he'd produced all these books, all these films. It was quite amazing. And he looked like he sort of, he maybe had monkey glands or something like that, because he looked so young, and he must have been sort of 20 or 30 years older than me at the time, and he just looked so good.
But he's back in fashion now with the students, isn't he?
Well, I should hope so. Yeah, it's good stuff. I mean, it's very sort of avant-garde and erotic. I mean, it was the erotic side of it that I liked, and the strangeness of the writing, and, you know, I'm interesting guy, interesting filmmaker. And the fact that Robbe-Grillet wrote books and also made films, and Margaret Duras did the same. You know, we don't have people like that in this country. Not really, no.
That was Anthea Page. Thank you very much to her for that feature. And now another track from Roxy Music.
yeah, you're so chic. Dude, where the love we babies up the mountain streamline. Midnight blue casino floors. Dance the cha-cha through till sunrise. Opens up exclusive doors for a while. Just like the windows look the same. So me and you, just we two, got to search for something new.
That was Roxy Music featuring Graham Simpson, interviewed at the Portobello Film Festival launch last week. Now time for Malcolm Grieve to read another instalment of Secrets and Lies. It's read by Malcolm Grieve, but written by David Southwell. And thank you very much to David Southwell for letting us read this book out on the air.
Secrets and Lies, drops from the fevered brow of David Southwell. What happens when something people in power do not want you to know about threatens to become public? They set up an official inquiry or other form of investigation to ensure a good old-fashioned whitewash, where lies are supported by a phalanx of selective facts and the truth is a secret buried in an unreported footnote. This might sound cynical, but any examination of the public inquiries, commissions, panels, committees and a host of other bureaucratic devices governments resort to when a public outcry is building shows they are rarely designed to reveal the truth. Those in power recognise an inquiry can not only calm public fears of a cover-up and draw the political sting out of an issue, but can also become a powerful mechanism for spreading the official version. If it is believed an inquiry is independent, the whitewash it produces can act as an enforcer of conformity and the orthodox view that reverberates throughout history. Although sold to the public as independent mechanisms for exposing secrets and lies, the nature of their composition, terms of reference, and limited investigative power means that, right from the word go, they will never produce a final report that reveals anything damaging to those who set up the investigation. The public rarely gets to see the hidden web of political patronage, shared interests and clandestine alliances that ensure that a supposedly autonomous commission has an invisible bias towards those in power or most at risk, should the full facts ever get out. On July 19, 1952, radar operators at Washington National Airport tracked an armada of blips on their screens, while through the glass in the control tower, their colleagues followed the fast-moving strange lights with their own eyes. The nearby Andrews Air Force Base, which also had the invaders of the US Capitol's airspace on their radar, scrambled attack jets. This set the pattern for the next 3 weeks. Mass sightings of UFOs confirmed by civilian and military radar contact, and fighters chasing UFOs over the White House itself. Not surprisingly, these events knocked the Korean War and approaching US presidential elections off the front pages. Occurring at the height of the Cold War, it is not surprising the UFO flap meant the public in Washington, D.C. were on the edge of hysteria. At the risk of losing all credibility for being unable to control the Capitol's airspace and unable to provide an explanation, the intelligence services formed the Advisory Panel on UFOs, Office of Scientific Intelligence. Headed up by physicist and CIA employee H.P. Robertson, the group of experts quickly became known as the Robertson Panel. However, instead of conducting a scientific and impartial investigation into what was happening in the skies above them, they quickly turned their considerable minds to conducting a whitewash that would calm top politicians' growing worries. Although unable to derive a conventional explanation that fitted the facts, the Robertson panel reported that most UFO sightings were the misidentification of clouds, planets and stars, and the remaining cases could also be explained away if given enough study, even those that turned up on the radar. The panel also suggested the government should begin a programme of serious debunking and run a secret public relations campaign using psychiatrists, astronomers and celebrities to reduce the public perception of UFOs as serious or threatening. They even suggested getting Walt Disney to help. Given this, it's not surprising that the US military got away with giving an official version that the events of 1952 were caused by a temperature inversion. In 1994, President Clinton faced a crisis when it emerged that the White House chief counsel, Bernard Nussbaum, had taken documents concerning the Whitewater Development Corporation from the office of Deputy White House Counsel Vince Foster when his dead body was found in Fort Macy Park. Bill and Hillary Clinton had invested in the property company and had been accused of fraud when the Securities and Exchange Commission investigated its bankruptcy. Facing a barrage of press speculation, Clinton did what most politicians in similar situations do. He called for an independent inquiry. Attorney General Janet Reno appointed a special prosecutor to investigate. When Kenneth Starr replaced original prosecutor Robert Fisk, the Clintons' allies claimed that the investigation was a witch hunt, while Hillary Clinton talked of a vast right-wing conspiracy. Using the classic tactics of refusing to cooperate and encouraging others to do the same, key witness Susan McDougall spent 18 months in jail for contempt after refusing Starr's questions. The inquiry dragged on until the public and press were bored. It was only when Starr discovered evidence of Bill Clinton's activities with Monica Lewinsky that the story was brought to life again. During this period, Clinton famously said, "I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky." Starr sent his report showing Clinton's perjury, obstruction of justice, witness tampering and abuse of authority to Congress. But in a total whitewash ignoring all of the evidence, the Democratic Party-nominated Senate acquitted Clinton of all charges. In March 2002, Robert Ray, the third prosecutor appointed to the case, finally delivered his report. It showed that, after 8 years of investigation costing more than $52 million, Bill Clinton could have been charged and might have been convicted in a federal court for lying under oath and other offences. However, Mr. Clinton's lawyers struck a deal with Mr. Ray to spare the president from criminal charges the day before he left office in January 2001, ensuring a Whitewater whitewash to the end. When BBC journalist Andrew Gilligan reported in May 2003 that Tony Blair's government had sexed up its dossier of intelligence information about Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction and probably knew that the claim the weapons could be launched in 45 minutes was wrong, everything changed. Within weeks, Gilligan's source for the report, government scientist Dr. David Kelly, was exposed in the press by the government and later found dead, apparently from suicide. And the BBC was under attack from Number 10. Gilligan was suspended, and Tony Blair established an inquiry under Lord Hutton to investigate the claims. After 6 weeks and £2.54 million in taxpayers' money, Hutton produced a report clearing the government of any responsibility for Dr. Kelly's death and suggesting that the accusations about the dossier were false. Even the normally loyal pro-Labour papers thought it was a whitewash. However, Blair demanded an apology. Gilligan left the BBC, as did its chairman and director general. A later inquiry by Lord Butler into the intelligence used to justify the war against Iraq showed just how much of a whitewash the Hutton inquiry had been. It proved that Tony Blair had lied when he twice claimed that Lord Hutton had seen all the intelligence on the case for war. It also showed that MI6 and the Joint Intelligence Committee knew intelligence had been withdrawn, but had not told this to Lord Hutton. Most importantly, it proved without a doubt that pressure had been brought by Number 10 to strengthen the report and that important caveats about the 45-minute claim had been removed. When the Butler report was published, Blair said he took full responsibility for any mistakes made, but claimed that they were made in good faith. According to Blair, no one lied. No one inserted things into the dossier against the advice of the intelligence services.
Unfortunately, Tim Burrows and Trevor Carter, our usual poets of the week, cannot be with us this week, but instead we do have a poem read by Malcolm Grieve.
Mass by Cesar Vallejo. At the end of the battle, the fighter lay dead. A man came to him and said, "Don't die. I love you too much." But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Two came to him and again said, "Don't leave us. Take heart. Come back to life." But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Then 20, 100, 1,000, 500,000 came, crying so much love, and yet so powerless against death. But the corpse, alas, went on dying. Millions surrounded him, pleading together, "Brother, don't leave us." And the corpse, alas, went on dying. Then all the men on earth stood round him. The corpse eyed them sadly, overwhelmed. He got up slowly, embraced the first man, started to walk.
Well, it's time for Jeff's Box What's On, so here we go. Good afternoon, this is your What's On guide from Daleks Radio. Starting with Wednesday the 1st of September, and Alien Stashtin will be performing at the Rifleman's Arms, which is at number 4 Chilkwell Street in Glastonbury. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and the entry is free. Moving on to Thursday the 2nd of September, Orchard Fever will be performing with support from She Tells Lies at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, here in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and entry is free. On to Friday the 3rd of September, the Atomic Rays will be performing at the Bunch of Grapes in Denmark Street. The gig starts at 8:30 and the entry is free. On Saturday the 4th of September, Beat Bullies will be performing with support from the Suitables at the Cooler in Park Street. The doors for that open at 7:30 p.m. and the tickets are £6 in advance. Finally, on to Sunday the 5th of September, James Morton and Friends will be performing at the Coronation Tap. And that's in Sign Place up in Clifton. And the gig starts at 9 and the entry is free. Thank you very much to Jeff, and he says, "Thank you for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye." And that's from Jeff, and he'll be back next week. Well, just before we go, a couple of things. Information on the Portobello Film Festival that we mentioned earlier on. You can find more about that at www.portobellofilmfestival.com. It starts on the 2nd of September, that's the official start, and it goes on until the 19th. And it is free admission to all venues. Well, that's all from Dialect Radio this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest. That was Harriet Biles. She spoke to us about travelling to the West Bank, and we hope to hear more from her in the coming weeks. The features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. And thank you very much to Malcolm Grieve for reading Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. We didn't have a poem this week, but I'm sure we will next week, hopefully. Thank you very much to Jess Sparks for writing the What's On, as per usual. And the studio engineer was Mike Noyce. The producer was Anthea Page, and I've been John Peters Coleman. Take care, goodbye.